You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
This is Hidden Kitchens, The Raw and The Cooked by The Kitchen Sisters. For more of their radio programming, visit kitchensisters.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Hidden Kitchens, the from The Kitchen Sisters and PRX. Hidden Kitchens, The Raw and The Cooked.
You have Mozart schnitzel here. You have Mozart sausages, Mozart coffee, Mozart orange juice. You have a cheese which is called Amadeus. Amadeus cake, a Mozart cake, a Wolfgang cake, chocolate balls, Mozart balls. The name Mozart is as famous as Coca-Cola. It's a kind of image which sells. Yeah, and Mozart sells.
Hidden Kitchens, an hour-long journey into the world of clandestine cooking, kitchen rituals and traditions, stories about the transformative power of food.
What did Mozart eat in his years in Vienna? Liver dumplings, sauerkraut, capon, you know, the castrated cock. I'm not interested in the genius Mozart. I'm not interested in the spirit. I'm interested in the flesh.
A special from The Kitchen Sisters and PRX. I'm your host, Frances McDormand. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome to Hidden Kitchens, The Raw and The Cooked, a new hour of stories produced by The Kitchen Sisters, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson. Kitchens that suddenly pop up, kitchens that stay underground to survive, kitchens that are the keepers of a culture, and cooking traditions that spring for the most unlikely moments of history. I'm your host, Frances McDormand. We begin at the crossroads. The Kitchen Sisters take us to Clarksdale, Mississippi, where barbecue, the blues, and a kind of Lebanese meatloaf meet. Kibbe at the Crossroads, a Delta Kitchen vision.
Lebanese food, we make it every Sunday, make kibbe and cabbage rolls. When I get depressed, I make grape leaves. I'm Pat Davis, Abe's Barbecue in Clarksdale, Mississippi, at the famous corner of 4961. We've been in business since 1924. My father was from Zahle, Lebanon. Came to America in the early 1900s. They moved to Clarksdale. They were doing good peddling. And back then, the Lebanese people mostly were peddlers. 1924, my father opened up a barbecue, a restaurant.
I went to the crossroads.
This is the main highway where the crossroads are. And we think that that's where Robert Johnson made a deal with the devil to play good blues music. Robert Johnson used to sit around where those sycamore trees were, playing his blues guitar, drinking a bud, and eating one of our barbecues.
They said the blues was born here in Clarksdale. We have a blues museum here. I don't want no more blues. I have blues when I was young. We used to have the blues in the field. In the old country, my mother singing all that sad songs, I'll never forget it. Cutting the wheat, picking the grapes. My name is Shafiq Shamoun. I live in Clarksdale since 1954. Me and my wife, Louise, we got Shamoun's Rest Haven. I would say the oldest restaurant in this Delta.
Great raw kibbe, great tabbouleh. We go there every January on the way to a duck hunt.
I'm Joe Sherman.
We were Shamoons. My grandfather, when he came across the border through Mexico, they Americanized it to Sherman. In the Rest Haven, it's got an old sign out front. And Mr. Shamoon, he'll be sitting there at a table with a telephone taking orders. If he's not, he's sick.
Rest Haven, may I help you? They order spaghetti, hamburger steak, kibbe sandwich. That's our best seller, kibbe sandwich.
Kibbe, it's pretty much the national food of Lebanon. It's a meatloaf of sorts. My father's family came to Mississippi Delta from Greater Syria. I'm Jimmy Thomas, managing editor for the New Encyclopedia of Southern Culture. One of the earliest stories of Lebanese in the South was a man who had come to the port of New Orleans, and he knew there were other Syrian immigrants there. So what he did, he stood on the dock and screamed, "Kibbe, kibbe, kibbe," until someone came.
When I came here in 1954, I bought about 24 of ladies' slips, nylon stockings. I saw that stuff go from house to house, 30 years. I tell you, the poor people in those days, they knew I was trying to make a living. They buy something just to help me.
Early on, I decided I wasn't going to be a peddler. My name is Sammy Ray, Professor Emeritus at Texas A&M at Galveston. My father was peddling dry goods to the black sharecroppers and was very dependent on the black community. That's where he made his money. My father's Syrian friends that were peddlers would come, and the big deal was the Lebanese picnic, taking a live goat or lamb to a riverbank. And my father would slaughter the kid, dress it. My mother would make rice, snow peas, and she would cook it in the stomach. In the early 30s, my father bought a barbecue stand in Rosedale, Mississippi, on the edge of Blacktown, and we lived in the back of the barbecue stand. In the early days, I had problems because of my color. I was too dark to play with the white folks, and I was too light to play with the black folks. I got beat up, called a Dago and a WAP.
We lived in Riverton. A lot of Italian-Americans, Lebanese-Americans lived in Riverton, along with African-Americans back then, you know. Tina Turner and Ike Turner worked for my uncle at the grocery store. We knew all these people. And to be honest with you, we were all in that category of not a real citizen, I guess.
In my kitchen.
Three black men came into the cafe, and this is probably in the 50s, and Daddy took their order. Four or five farmers, they started calling them names and told Daddy he needed to run them out of here. And Daddy said, "Look, they're coming here to eat something. Don't bother." When they left, they told my daddy, "You know, this is a good way to lose your business, serving black people." And we were tested in 1965. They got a bunch of kids, black kids, went to all the restaurants on the highway. And every restaurant refused them except Shafit's. Rest Haven is in my place. And everybody else got lawsuits against them.
We used to have this list of all these famous Lebanese people. Casey Kasem's Lebanese. Obviously, Cahill Gibran.
Ralph Nader, he's Lebanese. But the greatest person was Danny Thomas. I think I might have a CD of Danny Thomas singing a Thebe in my car, I think. We called ourselves Syrians when we first came here. And until Danny Thomas came and said he was Lebanese, then we all began to realize, you know, we really are Lebanese. Danny Thomas can say it, so we're Lebanese now.
Sunday was helped me make the kibbe. We'd always make a big thing of raw kibbe, and it kind of was on a mound about maybe an inch and a half high.
You get the round steak, real lean, grind it, a cup of wheat to each pound of meat. Soak it wheat for about an hour.
Bulgur wheat, lots of onions, cinnamon, salt, and pepper. And you can eat that raw, fried, or you can bake the kibbe.
And somebody would always take their palm of their hand, turn it up, and they'd make a cross in it, and then they'd put olive oil in it. Bless the kibbe, which kind of blessed the family.
Nikki found it.
Robert Johnson's grave. At the Mount Zion Baptist Church, Greenwood, Mississippi.
There are three cemeteries in Mississippi that claim Robert Johnson's grave. The Kitchen Sisters stopped at one outside Greenwood, where he rests under an old pecan tree.
Robert L. Johnson, May 8, 1911, August 16, 1938. Musician and composer. He influenced.
Robert Johnson isn't the only guitar player haunting the crossroads. When the Kitchen Sisters were filling up on kibbe in Clarksdale, they ran into James Super Chicken Johnson. His new record, Samo Chicken, was just hitting the shelves. Super Chicken can make a guitar out of anything.
Hello, people.
Old Army gas cans, hubcaps, cigar boxes, a Black & Decker toolbox. He told the sisters how much he is influenced by chickens.
I'm James Super Chicken Johnson, born and raised in Mississippi Delta. Back when I was a kid, I took care of the chickens. I had to keep the wolves and the foxes and the hawks away from the chickens, so I learned to call them.
Hidden Kitchens. The Sheepherder's Ball, a Basque kitchen vision. This story brings us to the remote and rugged world of Basque sheepherders in the American West and their outdoor Dutch oven below-the-ground cooking traditions.
My name is Francisco Lasarte.
My name is Joaquin Lasarte.
Basque sheepherder. You lonely. You by yourself, 2,000 sheep and 2 dogs. 3 years, you stay there. No vacation, no day off, no holidays. You stay 24 hours close to the sheep.
We make $7 a day. They pay you only once a year.
You cook outside, mostly under the ground. You make fire. You have a Dutch oven. You can cook bread. There's a lot of work to make bread.
You say Basque to a Westerner and they think shepherd. Basque country, very few people are shepherds. I'm Mark Kurlansky. I wrote a book called The Basque History of the World. Basques would go out in Western America and for the first time in their life have this huge flock of sheep over a huge expanse of land. Nobody has huge expanses of land in European Basque country.
In 1964, came to United States, North Spain, the Basque country.
They have a horrible life in Spain in that time because Franco, you cannot go anywhere, you cannot say anything. Only way you can came to United States, working sheepherders. Hundreds of people like that in that time in the Franco power.
The guys would come in from Ellis Island, make their way here. They were just told, go to Noriega Hotel in Bakersfield. Then their boss would pick them up.
I'm Bernadette Irigoyen, Noriega Hotel. I've been working here for 42 years. I have 3 brothers. They were sheepherders. And then I came to cook. Just guys, no women. I make stew and flan.
The worst part, I think, it's in the alfalfa. Because if you not take care of them, the alfalfas, a lot of sheep blow.
What do you mean they blow?
They blow. They eat. They never stop it on the gas. They blow it out. You can do huge damages.
It was very hard. 18-year-old kid who's been ripped up out of his community in Europe, and all of a sudden he's in a foreign land up on top of a mountain with a bunch of sheep. Amongst Bas, there's a whole vocabulary of madness. The sheep herder who goes over the edge, who becomes sagebrushed or sheeped.
It's called the Irinsi. It's a kind of a war whoop. You know, these people didn't have cell phones, and they would call from one area to another to get someone's attention.
You are listening to the Basque Hour, KBOI in Boise, Idaho.
My name is Rosita Alegria Artis. My mother was Espy Alegria. She had a Basque radio program that went out to the sheepherders, the voice of the Basque. They listened in their sheep camps. They had little transistors. She wished them happy birthday, gave them the soccer scores in Basque. She'd translate for them. If they had a problem with immigration, she did for them. They never paid her, but occasionally they would give her a lamb. We would throw it on the kitchen table and cut it up and freeze it.
The sheepherder, they organize barbecue and dance and everything. Big day for us.
I have a lot of pictures of Mom dancing at the Basque Sheepherder's Ball. The men wore Levi's and the women wore house dresses. Auctioned off a lamb. And they had chorizos, Basque sausage. The bread was the best part always.
Some more stories in a moment. I'm your host, Frances McDormand.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Frances McDormand. You're listening to Hidden Kitchens, the raw and the cooked. Sometimes we find the story, sometimes the story finds us. Nikki sat down next to this one at an NPR event in the Napa Valley. The sisters were on stage interviewing Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma. The topic was corn, and they played a little excerpt from their story on the 1930s kitchen visionary who invented the Frito. Over dinner, the 80-year-old woman seated by Nikki confided that she too had a hidden kitchen and began to tell the complicated saga of the birth of Rice-A-Roni.
Rice-A-Roni, the San Francisco treat. I'm Lois DiDomenico. I grew up in Edmonton, Canada. I met my husband, Tommy, in 1944 in San Francisco. His father and his brothers and he had a pasta factory. When the war was over, there was no place to live. All these hundreds of thousands of soldiers were coming home. So I saw this ad that said, lady who lived alone would like to rent out one room of her apartment. Mrs. Captanian. I had a liking for her right away. So we moved in. Tommy would work until, 7 o'clock every night at Golden Grain Pasta Company. I was alone a lot. I was only 18, and I was pregnant, and I had kitchen privileges. Well, I really wasn't much of a cook. And here was this Armenian lady, probably about 70 at the time, making yogurt on the back of the stove all day, every day. I didn't even know what the word yogurt meant.
My grandmother's name was Pailadzu Captanian. Grandma Cap is what we called her. My name is Ted Captanian. She babysat us when we were 4 or 5 years old. She would always be wanting to cook us stuffed grape leaves, baklava, and rice pilaf.
Pilaf, Armenian way. She taught me how to make that. We would bring her Golden Grain vermicelli. She wanted us to break it as small as rice if we could. The kitchen was teeny tiny, like a closet. But right around the corner was a huge big round table. And when she rolled out her dough for baklava, she would roll and roll until every bit of that dining room table was covered with this sheet of phyllo dough. She would hold it up and she would say, see, Lois, you have to be able to see through the dough. I can remember sitting there and Mrs. Captanian telling me her life story. She was in Armenia, 1915, 16, when the massacre happened, which, by the way, the Turkish people still don't agree that it ever happened. She was pregnant with one child and had two other boys.
This is a copy of her book, her memoirs of that exodus from Armenia. She wanted to guarantee that somebody knew what happened.
My name is Meline Pelivanyan, working in the Berlin State Library as the Armenia and Turkey specialist. About 15 years ago, I found by chance this little book from Pailadzu Captanian. It is a rare book. There are not so much first-hand memoirs of this time. It was 1915, the deportation of the Armenian population of Turkey began. Pailadzu Captanian left her two little sons with a Greek family. She knew that it would be death for all the Armenians. About 2 weeks later, the husband of Pailadzu is killed.
Where are my two children whom I abandoned? My heart is breaking with longing to see them again. Alone at night, I repeat cradle songs for their sake. And while I tell
Mrs. Captanian wrapped her feet in rags and walked through the Middle East.
There were only women, little children, and old men. They walked about 12 hours a day through mountains, and there were no food or little food.
Eventually, my grandmother made it to Syria, where she gave birth to my father after having walked for months to escape.
I used to sit in Mrs. Captanian's kitchen and listen to this amazing story of this woman. When I left her apartment, we got our own flat, and I made her Armenian pilaf a lot. One night, my husband and his brother Vincent were eating pilaf in my kitchen. Vincent looked at it and he took it apart and he said, you know, this would be great in a box.
We had a kitchen down in the plant. He would cook the dish up and we would taste it. I would bring home some samples and ask my wife how she liked it. Shake a baby, shake it, cause you love it when we needed a name for the product. We were saying, well, what is the product? Rice and macaroni. Why don't we call it Rice-a-roni? The name had a ring to it.
Rice-a-roni, the San Francisco treat.
Rice-a-roni, the delicious break from potatoes.
There were not very many packaged side dishes in the market in 1955. I'm Dennis DiDomenico, son of Lois and Tom DiDomenico. Everything was being geared towards less time in the kitchen, dishwashers and garbage disposals. The convenience factor was everything.
When I was young, we'd see these commercials for Rice-a-roni. Every time we hear that jingle, my father would say, you know, your grandmother gave a rice recipe to the people who started that company. So every time you hear it, you can think of your grandmother. To be honest, we kind of thought, could that possibly be true, that this iconic American dish, could that actually be attributed to some recipe my Armenian grandmother gave to someone years ago?
I still make pilaf the way Mrs. Kaptanian taught me. The impact she had on me and my life, I only lived there 4 months, but it was 4 months that brought all these things together. Myself from Canada, Tommy, Italian, Mrs. Kaptanian, Armenian, all that converging in San Francisco in 1946. And out of that comes Rice-a-roni.
Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you apple, plum, and every god I do. Come on to my house.
That's Rosemary Clooney, George's aunt, singing Come On to My House, a song based on an old Armenian children's rhyme and adapted by the Armenian-American novelist William Sororian and a friend. Peach and a pear and a love of your hair.
Come on to my house.
Writer Michael Pollan is best known for his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. The Kitchen Sisters have talked with him about a lot of kitchen issues, not just corn, including this poorly recorded conversation about the future of fuel.
Imagine you're creating the car of the future, or the fuel source of the future. How are cars running?
Cars are running on waste. Cars are running on, French fry oil. Solar collectors on top of cars, and cars are running on grass. Grass is very efficient at taking solar energy and turning it into carbohydrates and cellulose. And perhaps we can find efficient ways to take that grass and turn it into energy, just like cows. We turn our cars into ruminants. I think that's my dream. We give them rumens instead of engines. Maybe you just drive them over a grassland, or actually your car, you drive it across your lawn, and it mows the lawn and takes that grass into its rumen and turns it into a fuel source. That's how I would picture it.
I like the vision of a stomach instead of an engine.
We're really getting out there, Davia. You know, I think the thing to do is keep your eye on the sun. Figure out ways to take that solar energy, which is the basis of all fuel, after all, even gasoline, is fossilized solar energy, and collect it, because that really is the only free lunch we have in nature, is this energy source that's pouring down every day. That's where we need to get our energy.
Many hidden kitchen traditions come out of dark times when surviving means adapting. We peer into a corner of America's not too distant past, the internment camps of World War II, where more than 100,000 people of Japanese descent, most of them American citizens, were incarcerated without trial for the duration of the war, their homes and livelihoods taken from them. Winnie Royale, The Impact of the Internment on Japanese Cooking in America.
My name is Akemi Tamaribuchi, and I'm third-generation Japanese-American. During World War II, my family was interned in Tule Lake internment camp. I'm positive that so many of the dishes that I grew up eating stemmed from what they had in camp and how they incorporated that into their tastes. Fried bologna with a little sugar and a little soy sauce on top, hot dogs and everything. They use things like ketchup and hot water for soup bases. We eat ketchup on everything. Winnie Royale and Hamburger Royale, they're my favorites. Sunday mornings we always had sliced hot dogs mixed with eggs, with soy sauce and a little oyster sauce, stir-fried in with some onions over rice.
My father was Ito Ikemoto. Everybody called him Ed. He made that his official name after the war. He was a grocer. He had three grocery stores, and he lost them all, of course. My name's Howard Ikemoto. After the war, a lot of the Japanese came back to places like Sacramento, and they had no jobs. And a lot of them got pickup trucks and became gardeners. And I was 12 years old. I would go every Saturday to work with my father. Every lunch, all the Japanese gardeners would meet in front of people that they were mowing lawns for. We used to eat rice with one plum in the middle, and then maybe have a slice of Spam, corned beef hash out of a can. That was part of our main diet in camp. And while they were having their lunch, they would talk about the camps, which was the prime of their life.
My name is Tammy Takahashi. I'm a native of San Francisco. I went to UC Berkeley in the 30s, the depths of depression. I lived my whole life here, except for the 4 years of World War II. Everybody, if they had a drop of Japanese blood, 1/16, we were all gathered up and put into camps. Our camp, Topaz, each person was given a tin pie plate that held our meals. Even now, 70 years later, if I look at a tin pie plate, it brings back memories.
My name is Moss Kawaguchi. I'm 79 years old. When I was evacuated, they sent me over to Tamfram Racetrack. I had to live in a stable 6 months. You could still see the hairs on the floor, and you could still smell the horses. They told us that you're supposed to bring your own mess gear. Being a Boy Scout, I knew what to bring. They had a big hall. All 8,000 of us had to march in there with your mess gear in hand.
You lined up for your food and then sat down at these long tables and ate there. Everybody squeezed in where they could. Just broke apart the family because the kids were running around. There was no family dinner.
Somebody else was cooking your dinner. It wasn't your mother. That part of the family life was just institutionalized. My name is Jean Wilkotsky Houston. I was 7 years old. We went to Mazanar. It was bleak, desert.
The cook in our mess hall and Block 11 was a Coast Guard military cook, a grizzly old cranky guy, not very friendly disposed to the idea of children and women. It was determined that only children from birth to 12 years of age would be given 6 ounces of milk, maximum. And I was pregnant, but he wouldn't give me any milk.
We were very unused to eating potatoes. It's not something that was part of our regular diet. My father and mother ate rice every day of their life. Rice is certainly a soul food for Japanese Americans.
They had dirt floors in the barracks, My great-grandmother would dig a hole and ferment her own rice wine or sake and store it buried in the dirt. That was a big secret. It wasn't allowed in camps.
Every block had sake makers. Everybody had any connection with the mess hall. They scrape all the rice off the bottom of the pan and they'll make sake. My name is Jim Yamaichi. I spent 3 years in Tui Lake.
You see that concrete thing over there? There used to be a guard tower in that corner. That's the slaughterhouse where they slaughtered the hogs, rendering the fat. The soap was made right there and took into the mess hall. This is where the chicken coop used to be.
Tui Lake was one of the biggest farm camps. We supplied most of all the vegetables to other camps. 3,800 acres of farmland. Internees did the farming. You bring a carload of hot dogs and come in by the tons. We eat hot dogs for days, you know.
My father decided he was going to have a family dinner Christmas time, and he was going around the camp bragging to his friends that he was going to have a goose for Christmas. Everybody was mocking him. There was no place to cook a goose, and then where are you going to get a goose anyway, right? Tule Lake is a flyway for Canadian geese. So he dug this trench and laid down, put some gunny sack over himself, and put feed in the trench. And sure enough, the geese came down and their wings were trapped. My father threw the gunny sack onto the geese. Every barrack had this potbelly stove, and he actually roasted it in there. And we had our Christmas goose.
My name is Shosei Hanayama, minister of Watson Buddhist Temple. After World War II in Yokohama, so many Americans came, Army and Navy, and they brought, you know, a hot dog. It's an American cuisine, you know, every year, Independence Day. They have a contest in New York City. Japanese young guy, you know, every year he ate over 50 hot dogs he ate in a couple of minutes.
This year's Nathan's hot dog eating contest. Takiro Kobayashi hoping to swallow the competition.
He'll show us a couple different looks. Right now he's Japanese-ing and solid-ing. He's breaking the dog in half, separating dog from bun. Still the man to be beat. He is the Lance Armstrong of our
city. Some of my closest friends never even heard of the fact that the Japanese were interned. And there's so many things that have affected our culture, at least that came out of there, like the food. To be honest, I think that the Japanese culture is very silent. Nobody ever complains or talks about any bad times. And my grandmother, my oba-chan, she's 85 years old. Now she has all of a sudden become far more sensitive to wanting all of her family to understand where everything came from. You know, we lost so much of it. It's just like, call all the grandkids and Bachan's making weenie royale for breakfast. Come spend time so that you learn how to make this food so you can make it for your children and their children.
If you would like recipes for kibbe, weenie royale, bass bread and lamb baked in a Dutch oven, and much, much more, they are all available at HiddenKitchens.org. You're listening to Hidden Kitchens, the raw and the cooked. A special from the Kitchen Sisters and PRX. An hour-long journey into the world of clandestine cooking. Kitchen rituals and traditions. How communities come together through food. I'm your host, Frances McDormand. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to Hidden Kitchens, the Raw and the Cooked, inspired by the Hidden Kitchen series, heard on NPR's Morning Edition. Travel down Highway 5, straight into the heart of California's Central Valley, the nation's breadbasket, where the rates of juvenile obesity, type 2 diabetes, and malnutrition are some of the highest in the country. The Kitchen Sisters explore some of the hidden causes of this epidemic and the local kitchen visionaries grappling with it. Breadbasket Blues.
My name is Yesenia Ayala. I'm 20 years old. I was raised here in Kettleman City, population of 2,500. Kettleman was real rich for its oil. Its oil wells was going to bring a lot of people out here, but it never happened. We are a rural community surrounded by fields and crops. We don't have grocery stores, which is very hard. We have to drive 35 miles in order to get to our nearest grocery store. Up there, we have Carl's Jr. We have In-N-Out Burger. This place is always packed. Next door, we have a McDonald's. Most of the youth in Kettleman, they work out here in the fast food restaurants. When I was in high school, I worked at Taco Bell. When I was working there, I was overweight. We would get our break, then we would just go eat out to Jack in the Box. You see them before they start working in a fast food restaurant, how slim, and then you see them working up there, and it's like, oh, what happened to her?
The Central Valley has been described as sort of the new Appalachia. These are the poorest congressional districts with some of the worst health disparities in California. I'm Genoveva Islas Hooker, Central California Regional Obesity Prevention Program. Our focus is to look at obesity from an environmental and policy standpoint. Poor communities do not have the infrastructure that supports active lifestyle. We don't have sidewalks, we don't have streetlights. There's packs of dogs. They don't walk because there's nobody in their community that gets the loose dogs. We don't have access to stores, to healthy produce. We've created this very obesogenic environment, and we question why so many people are overweight and at risk for type 2 diabetes. Well, we've engineered it.
Here we're living in a region that produces the finest fruits and vegetables in the world, and yet the children of this valley rarely taste those fruits and vegetables. My name is Mark Arax. I grew up in Fresno. I came back here as a writer for the Los Angeles Times. My grandfather, when he came here in 1920 from Armenia, he became a migrant fruit picker. We have created here the most intensive farm belt the world has ever known. Agriculture done at a speed and intensity that's never been done by man. And yet, right next to that agriculture is this stunning poverty. The neighborhoods in Fresno have the most concentrated poverty of any city in the country. New Orleans was second in this last survey. And all that pathology that goes along with poverty, you know, drugs, and we produce more meth and more milk than any region in the country.
In the Central Valley, the healthy food that's picked is shipped out and then shipped back in to be sold in our grocery stores. In Fresno, we discovered there was actually a zoning ordinance that prohibited the establishment of farmers markets. We had to work at creating a new zoning ordinance that would allow farmers markets in the last year.
These are the hills. You can see it's just like a desert. Rattlesnakes. If you go walking out there, you'll see mostly older people that have diabetes, where the doctors told them to go walk. Because even though people would want to walk in town, it's very hard with having no sidewalks. You'll see people walking with a stick just in case of a dog. We do have that dog problem here in Kettleman.
Appearing to be aggressive. Parks and Grounds.
CSPCA Animal Shelter. All lines are busy at this time.
In Fresno County, we have probably one of the biggest dog bite areas. I'm Beth Caffrey with the Central California SPCA. We started working with Fresno County Healthy Neighborhoods Program, finding out why people don't exercise as much, why they don't go outside. There's a lot of stray dogs and animal packs that make people nervous about going out into their own neighborhood. A lot of people get animals because there's so much theft. Sometimes they want to have the toughest dog. It's typically tied to gangs and fighting your dogs.
There is a large amount of gang activity here in Central California.
My name is Keith Padgett, SPCA, Fresno, California.
The most prevalent
is the Bulldogs. Gang members have taken our Fresno State mascot as their symbol.
Gang food, I would describe it as munchy food. If you're smoking marijuana, you might want some chips and sodas. I don't think they're eating their five fruits and vegetables a day, unfortunately. The young boy in Arosi, on his way to get some milk at a convenience store, was shot. Gang culture has been affecting the food environment. It's made it inhospitable just to walk to go to get some milk. When community members are telling us, you know, I don't want my children out, I drive them to school even though it's two blocks away, it's for some very real issues.
My name is Maria Peña, the Greenfield Walking Club in Bakersfield. We started 3 years ago. We're trying to teach each other how to eat healthy, exercise.
These women wanted to form a walking group in Bakersfield. There was a park, but there was gang activity happening there, loose dogs, syringes. They began to talk with the city council members. Lights got repaired. Graffiti got removed. These women raised money to establish a walking path around the park. In Lindsay, a small rural community, they have Friday night markets. There's food, activities for kids, dance, music, produce vendors. They've had a reduction in crime.
Friday nights, families are here, the husbands, their kids, and they're dancing, they're eating. Any other day, there's nobody around town.
As long as people are indoors because of their fear, they won't come out. If we created more forums where neighbors could meet each other, days in the park, farmers markets, community gardens, environments that promote a healthier lifestyle, there's real power when the community members themselves advocate for these changes.
It's called the Diamond Dairy. It's a kosher restaurant, you know. The clientele on the street are mostly diamond dealers.
The Diamond District, New York City.
On this street, it's like a small town. Everybody knows. Where do you get a good kosher meal in New York? They'll say, boom, up there. Many, many elderly Jewish men who possibly are widowers. This is a home-cooked meal to them, seriously speaking. You go into the kitchen, it looked like the grandmother of all Jewish grandmothers. And she's back there cooking. In Jewish, it's called Hamishah, which is home, you know, no meat. It's a dairy-type restaurant. The coffee is weak. Jewish coffee is always weak. You want strong coffee, don't go to a Jewish restaurant.
The specials are eggplant, parmesan, bow ties and cabbage, noodles, noodles and cheese, cheese crepe.
You say hidden kitchen because it's out of the way. You would never notice it if you walked down the street. But it's only hidden to stranger to the area, that's all. When guys sit down to have lunch, you'll hear mostly diamond talk. That's what the conversation is about here all day long. There is a room back there where at 4 o'clock they gather to pray. Not that it's a temple, but they use it. They all gather together because they have to have a minyan, which is a certain amount of men that you have to have to have a prayer session. Diamond Dairy Restaurant, 4 West 47th Street. You know, I just love the food. That's it. I'm not kosher at all.
Aren't the blintzes great? They're like feathers. Fantastic.
Kitchens and mothers. The food they cooked or didn't. The stories they told or couldn't. Hidden Kitchen Mama.
I called her Mama because, she's my mama. I didn't find out that my mother was white until I was 10 years old, and that my black mama was, in fact, my grandmama. I am Ellen Sebastian Chang. I grew up in a small farm town called Pasco in eastern Washington. It was a lot of transplanted people from Louisiana, Mississippi. It's where the Hanford Nuclear Power Plant was built. My grandmother sometimes would say, go get my wig. We're going to go down to the atomic market. I'm going to get some greens and some ham hocks. And she was a great cook, and she had a big laugh. I remember playing with the neighbor children. They said, Rose ain't even your mama. Your mama's white. I've been called a half-breed most of my life, and I just said, Mama, they say, you're not my real mama. And she said, I am your mama, and I will always be your mama. But I'm not your mother. I didn't bring you into this world. She showed me a picture of this white woman, and she said, and this is your mother. I fly to San Francisco and meet my mother. I'm with more white people than I've ever been with in my life. And at the end of the hall, I can see these two hippie women, and one's in a pair of jeans. She had cowboy boots on. That was my mom with the John Lennon wireframe glasses. And now what do I do? And my mom says, well, let's get some food. Let's go to Safeway. I'd never seen such a big grocery store. So I came upon this thing, and I picked it up. And I said, what is this? And she says, oh, it's an artichoke. Well, would you like to get that? And I said, sure, you know. And I just remember her, like, cutting off the bottom of the artichoke and putting it in the water to boil it. And she puts this thing on the table, and it's still really tough. So here's what you do. She said, you pull the leaf back, and you dip it in the lemon, and then you scrape your teeth on it. She shows me how to scoop the hairs out of the heart. And I said, wow. I said, you do all that work. It's just kind of a big mess. And you're throwing away more than you ate. And I think if my mama was sitting there, she would say, this is how you came into the world. It was just a tough situation. And you just have to peel back and peel back all this stuff. And it's just a big mess. And yet, at the heart of it, it is really tender.
I'm Peggy Knickerbocker. I'm a food writer from San Francisco and the daughter of a very good cook. My mother was an only child. She was a very beautiful woman. Both of her parents got married after their former spouses had shot themselves. And I think she was a tortured soul. She was very smart. She was one of those people that was of a generation where she didn't work, you know, and she was frustrated. We had a beautiful kitchen that was green and white, black and white tile floor. And she puttered there after dinner, straightening things out, alphabetizing the spices. The kitchen was her domain. It was kind of like men who have, you know, a shop or they have a fly tying room. It was her hidden kitchen. It was her secret space. And it was a place she could unapologetically drink. Just about everything she cooked had alcohol in it. She made Welsh rarebit, which is that melted cheese thing that had beer in it, so she'd swig on the beer as she was stirring it into the pot. She loved to make desserts with hard sauce because you could have the bourbon there, coq au vin or boeuf bourguignon, and she made this other thing called wine jello, gelatin and lemon juice and marsala. And whenever I'd come home from school, there'd be little nips, little spoonfuls taken out of it. Some days I'd come home, she'd be so happy to see me, and sometimes she'd be furious. The kitchen was her refuge. And it was really where I felt most comfortable with her because she was happiest there.
My mother's name was Josefina Salas Porras Acevedo, but everyone called her Pipina. My mother's family were French-Mexican, and she always used to tell us, you came from kings and queens. My name's Cristina Salas Porras from El Paso, Texas. I'm the youngest of six kids, and my mom used to say, don't call me unless there's blood. You know, so we tended to deal with things amongst ourselves. We had a big kitchen, you know, kind of had Mexican tiles, and it opened to the garden. My mom, I don't think she really loved cooking. It wasn't so much about the food, it was about eating together. Every day around sunset, she'd pour herself una copita de tequila, a little light blue, beautiful, thin glass the size of a thimble. And she'd squeeze a big lime in there. And she wasn't a drinker. That was just her one little thing. It made her slow down, connect with us. And, okay, everybody, stop. Let's all take account of where we are. My mom was very loved. And there was hundreds of people at her funeral. And we passed out little glasses and served tequila to everyone at the cemetery. and we let off some white doves. We toasted her, and the mariachis were playing, the doves were flying around, and it was the right way to say goodbye to her.
My mother stayed awake a lot of hours of the day. I rarely ever saw her asleep. Her hidden kitchen was in the middle of the night. I'm Nick Spitzer, and I'm the host of American Roots. I live now in New Orleans, a long way from New England, where I grew up. The kitchen was a place where she would take care of the family's bills. She'd always be clipping from newspapers and plan the meals for the week, make all the bag lunches. It was where all the medicine was kept, where she would sit and read Joy of Cooking, just as surely as she would sit and read the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin. And the only time I ever invaded that sphere was because she was afraid of mice. So she used to wake me up to come empty mouse traps that she would hear clack in the house in the middle of the night. After school, she'd give us tea and pound cakes. She also always had massive place settings, a main fork, a salad fork, a dessert fork. The good manners and treating people well was a centering force for her. She had an expression that she used with us as kids, which was, "Twixt cup and lip, civilization hangs in the balance."
So tell me, what is your hidden kitchen? Who glues your community together through food? How are your kitchen rituals and traditions getting you through the good times and the hard? Who's cooking on your street corner? Who's running the underground farmer's market that just sprang up in your town? Who's bartering the fruit from their trees in exchange for some car repair? Who's raising sheep and chickens on an abandoned lot in a downtown urban ghost town? Who are the new girls that just opened up the butcher shop on that corner? Who's the beekeeper on the rooftop of the apartment building across the street? And the Italian guy who cooks pasta for the veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan and listens to their stories of war and return? Who is gleaning the harvest and canning jam in the fields? Who hasn't gotten enough to eat? Who's making sure they have a meal? Who would you like to cook for? And what do you long to eat? All these hidden kitchens in plain view, if you know where to look. Hidden Kitchens, The Raw and the Cooked, was produced by the Kitchen Sisters, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, and mixed by Jim McKee. Our series was produced in collaboration with Jay Allison and NPR's Morning Edition, with production help from Laura Folger, Nathan Dalton. Special thanks to Ellen McDonald. Major funding for this special was provided by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Newman's Own Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Funding has also been provided by the Pig Roast in a Parking Lot fundraiser hosted by Angelo Garo, Boz Gags, Alice Waters, and Michael Pollan. We thank them and over 300 members of the community who came together to make Hidden Kitchens, The Raw and the Cooked possible. Further support was provided by Cowgirl Creamery. We're beginning a new wing of the project, Hidden Kitchens World, with stories from around the globe. You can call or write or send us a picture, video, or recipe from wherever you discover them. Our email is kitchen@kitchensisters.org. It's a global kitchen collaboration, and we want you to be a part of it. Hidden Kitchens, from the Kitchen Sisters and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. With the Kitchen Sisters, I'm Frances McDormand.
Listening to Hidden Kitchens, The Raw and the Cooked by the Kitchen Sisters. For For more of their programming, visit kitchensisters.org.